It's time to talk about the outdoors in South Alabama. Hunting, fishing, and getting outside along the Great Gulf Coast. It's time to take it outside with FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Brought to you in part by Trailer Sales Alabama. A great selection of high-quality trailers at great prices. Financing available. Trailer Sales Alabama on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Now, with reports, stories, how-to information, and Dr. Bill's Marine Forecast, here's Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward.
All right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward.
Glad to be here. How about you, Sean?
I'm glad to be here hanging out with you and talking hunting.
You've been out of town for a week.
Yeah, so
trying to kill you a big old buck.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that in future shows. Went up to Pennsylvania, took a little time off.
Yeah,
and
hunt in the snow a little bit.
Got to hunt in the snow. Got to tons of rack bucks, and had a good hunt. My buddy killed one. We mentioned before I went to you talk about a state that's trying to deal with their black bears.
Yeah,
they started issuing black bear tags. It was $30 out of state over the counter. Black bear tag during their rifle season for deer when believe me, there's a lot of people in Pennsylvania, my kinfolk up there included, that are in the woods, come they're 14 days basically of rifle season, 7 days it's just bucks, and then buck or doe for the other 7 days.
Yeah.
And they put bear tags on the list, and it was, they were dry. They killed,
I'm sure they got,
killed,
I got the,
they
got
killed
the
one
quota.
At 810 pounds while we're up there.
Oh, man.
810.
That's a grizzly bear.
That's what we talked about. It's bigger than the interior grizzly. All right, well, we're going to keep the deer discussion going here in the state of Alabama on this week's show. And joining us, Chris Cook, the deer program coordinator from the Alabama Division of Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries. Getting him back on the show is a good thing. Hey, Chris.
Hey, how are y'all?
Man, doing fine, Chris.
We're good. And I want to talk about a whole bunch here, but let's do a little review. In the rear view mirror, data coming in there, how's it been so far? What are you hearing in your office? How's deer season 2019-2020?
It's been pretty good so far based on reports we're getting from folks. There's been some pretty good deer killed in areas where they have a pretty good number of nice bucks killed opening day regardless. And then you're having some pretty good deer killed in areas where we have a little bit earlier rut, and so they're getting the benefit of that right now. But it appears to be off to a pretty decent start. There's a lot of appears to be a lot of acorns out there, so folks are going to have to contend with that, and because that can affect where the deer are, and a lot of times they're not necessarily where the deer. Or where the hunters want them to be.
Wait a second. You mean people are having to get out of box stands and get in the woods?
Well, with our new baiting privilege, that some of them aren't as seeing as good results with their bait as they will later in the year, of course.
Chris, I can
just eat those. They'll eat acorns most of the time over anything else. So.
I can contest to that. I've had cameras out on my feeders for. Ever since September.
Right.
And I've been seeing plenty of deer, lots of hogs. Tons of hogs, but some nice deer. And all of a sudden, 2 weeks before opening day of deer season, the hogs left, the bucks left.
Yep.
And it's like, what in the world happened? And I knew, I said, I there's a big acorn or a big oak flat across the street from me, and I know that is where the hogs went, and that's where the deer went. They feeding on natural acorns. They're not eating on that corn right now. At least where I'm at, they're not.
Yeah, that's the case in a lot of places. I know the few times I've been able to go hunting, there's as many acorns, at least where I was at, that I've ever seen. So,
yeah.
Whether they'll... most of them are white oaks. The red oaks, I think, are really starting to drop now more than anything else. But the white oaks are just unbelievable, the number that were on the ground. And deer, there were so many that most of the trees, you couldn't see a lot of sign where deer had been eating them. But every tree had some. So they had a lot of choices.
That's always tough during bow season. I love a good acorn crop just for the benefit to the wildlife on the property, but I sure like it when one is producing more or out ahead. You find a swamp chestnut or a white oak that is just like the tree, and the other ones are just not falling yet or something. That's when you got a 10-acre flat that has all the acorns falling, you can see them, but when you're bow hunting, you're like, there they are.
Yeah.
I want to also talk about where we are. How many years have we been on antler restriction in the state?
Oh, it's been, I think this is the 12th year.
I mean, are we seeing the...
Well, it's 12th year, I think, of the buck limit. And, one of those deer having four on one side. So I guess that's, I think that's right. I believe it was 2007, I think, when it started. It's been so long ago, you almost forgot.
Well, I'm just wondering, it's been a long time, but now it's cycled through a couple times here, and you're talking about the good bucks that are being shot. Now, on a lot of managed properties, people have been putting those limits or heavier limits on themselves for a long time, but I wonder on other properties, or even I look at the pictures that come in from the WMAs in the state, some fantastic bucks. I wonder if those people that were worried about that back then are going, oh, okay, I get it.
Yeah, I think a lot of the, at least, interactions I've had with a lot of folks that hunt on the WMAs. There are a lot of them that, they take ownership of the WMAs just like anybody would on the hunting lease or land they own. They see it as their place. And so they understand that, if we want to see better deer than passing some of these two-year-olds, is that's the only way it's going to happen. And so they're as adamant about it as anybody on a lease property. And then, of course, a lot of the WMAs have antler restrictions now. And for that very reason, trying to get the two-year-old deer. And folks seem to have bought off on it for the most part. So, we've had some of our WMAs, I guess Barbara was the first one. It's been under antler restrictions for all bucks for, I can't remember
forever.
How long it is. And, and then Geneva State Forest was the second one in Lowndes. And so there's a lot of them that's been doing it for a long time, but there's several others that have changed in the last few years. But
is it stricter antler reduction?
Basically the restrictions we have on our regular WMAs, the ones that have them, is basically something in place to try to protect year-and-a-half-old bucks.
Yeah.
It's nothing. We're not trying to get them to 3 and 4 years old. But by default, there's more of them reach those ages.
Sure.
There's more of them getting to 2 years old.
So. Yeah, they got to pass through 1.5 to get to 5.5.
And so the antler restrictions are just we're mainly put there primarily for to protect the 1.5-year-old deer and tried to make them as conservative as we could. Didn't want to make them
too restrictive.
They won't make them to where they were select, that you weren't protecting a big percentage of those 1.5-year-old deer, but you also wanted to make them to where if a deer come by that was 2 years old, he should meet those criteria. And so we're using antler point number restrictions on those areas, and some of them work great, and some of them, it's not as good as it could be just because of that's just the nature of using antler point restrictions. They don't work great everywhere because you have a lot of overlap in age classes, especially in areas where you have deer that are either born really really late or born really early compared to the average, because the ones that are born early, you're going to have some of those yearling bucks that's going to have 6, 7, 8 points. And then on the other hand, ones that are born really late that have ruts in February, you're very likely going to have some 2.5-year-old bucks that are going to struggle to have 4 points.
Total,
So you got a fine line there in some places, but fortunately on most areas it works pretty well. Most of them have a 3-on-1 side rule, which works for most of them. There's a couple that I think Black Warrior and I think Chocolaca have 4-on-1 side primarily because of their really early rut dates. And then on our special opportunity areas, they're a little different. We have different animal restrictions there because we're trying to get them to basically 3+. But on the regular WMAs, we try to keep it as simple as possible but still accomplish that goal of getting deer to 2+ years old on some of them.
Yeah, that's the tough thing, that it's site-specific. We all know from different management, so it's got to be tough to pass something for the entire state. I get the issue there, but I wonder in this, I feel like you're managing people as much as you are deer in this. You're managing humans, because if I know, I hunted WMAs for many years, and if I know the next guy down the line is going to pass that buck too, it makes it easier for me to pass that deer.
Yeah, that's the case. And with a lot of our WMAs, they've gone through a change over the last 15, 20 years to where, you know, they used to be, especially a lot of the older ones, like Okmulgee and Chocolaca and Coosa and all those areas that, you know, we've had as WMAs since the 40s and 50s. They were destination places. People were, you know, planning vacations and come and hunt on those areas because those, you know, they were coming from parts of the state where deer numbers weren't that great. And they were coming to these areas that had deer. And now, a lot of these areas, they're hunted basically by local folks. You know, people within 30, 45 minutes of the WMA. So it's I think that has had a big part of it, too, where it's what they've been doing on their own private land they've been hunting around in there. So it's not foreign to them. And so they feel better about doing it. It's not a, we're just going to go kill a deer because that's the only place in the state to kill a deer. And so there's deer everywhere now. So, it's, you know, there's a lot of things working in that. But I think that's a change in the mindset of a lot of those guys. And like I said before, they've taken ownership of those WMAs like it's their, you know, their club. And so it's a lot easier for them to do it. And the folks that, They know a lot of the other guys that are hunting out there, and it's like a really, really big hunting club for a lot of them. So it's worked out pretty well.
And, I know y'all are doing really good, especially some of the northern WMAs like Bankhead. I see some of the monster bucks come out of these places.
Yeah, that, and you know Bank or Black Warrior up there in Bankhead National Forest. It's one of those. It breaks the bell curve on what you typically see because it's got a lot of things working in favor. It's real early rut, and those deer, you know, they were, you know, everybody probably knows the history of it, where it was restocked with deer from Michigan, and those deer, we've done some genetic stuff with Mississippi State just recently, and that was one of the few places in the areas that they sampled in Alabama and other states that were stocked with deer from northern states way back when that still show those same, they're still very similar if not identical to deer from the source. So they've maintained those northern genetics and they just have bigger frames. Talking to the guys up there that have worked on Bankhead and Black Warrior for years and handled a lot of deer that hunters kill, they say they're just different. You know, they have just a bigger frame, the hair's different on them, and they.
Right.
If you go up there to Bankhead and look around, you know, somebody just not knowing what deer are killed there, they would look at it and say, "Man, this is some pretty bad. This habitat doesn't look very good at all." You know, you'd never grow and produce really big bucks up here, but then something. Don't know if it's something, you know, with the just those northern subspecies of whitetail that just make better use of that, you know, the ups and downs in acorn crops primarily. You know,
well, that's what I was
make better use of it than deer from the southeast where they have, you know, they have food throughout the year. They don't go through those really, really bad, tough times in the winter like northern deer, and so you don't know what all happened there in the evolution of those subspecies, but and I've talked to some folks in Georgia, which is the same way. They've got pockets over there that would stock with deer from Wisconsin, and they saw the same thing. It's a big difference in it appears to be a big difference in what those deer are able to do following like a really good acorn crop as far as producing antlers and whatnot. But it's always been a place that produced some really good deer, and now I think probably the cat's out of the bag, and with social media, more of those get posted than they used to, and so.
Yep.
And then having, you know, we've been fortunate where we've been able to have that early gun hunt up there, and then have the muzzleloader hunts, and so guys have, guys have come in and taken advantage of it, and it killed some really good deer.
Hey, we're coming right back. We'll talk more about this. Chris Cook, Deer Program Coordinator with Alabama Division of Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries. He's mentioned it a couple times, too, dancing around the subject of the rut, this new rut map out for the state of Alabama, showing the big range of rut peak dates for Alabama. Y'all going to love this. Get into that discussion a whole lot more when we come back right here on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward, glad to have you all along on this Saturday morning. And love our discussion. We need to do this more often, except I mean, it's like a year since last time we talked. Chris Cook, Deer Program Coordinator for the Alabama Division of Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries. Chris is going to cringe here, but we make him like a weekly guest on this stuff. Chris, yeah, we were having, if people are just catching up with the show, we're talking about, we got a discussion about Bankhead National Forest and the WMAs in there and the size of deer coming out of there. And you said that was a strain of deer. Those were restocked from where? Where did they come from?
They came from Iron Mountain, Michigan, is what the restocking records show, back in the 20s.
Okay. Yeah, and my thought was, I mean, I'm not familiar with that area, and I see all these big deer being killed up there, and I'm thinking, man, that must be a real good area where there's a lot of woods, but there must be a lot of farming around there because they're killing all these great big deer up there, because down here, down central Alabama, and all, you kill some big deer, Alabama native deer, that are around all the farming. But if you get away from the farming, you don't kill any big deer, typically hardly, anymore. So is there farming up around Bankhead?
Yeah, you know, the thing with Bankhead or Black Warrior WMA, which is in Bankhead, it's our the WMA that we operate, which is Forest Service land, it's 98,000 acres. So that's a 98,000 block acre block of typical U.S. Forest Service land. You know, it's forest.
Just
so
forest.
There's
no
some
farming.
Openings and a few in holdings of private property, but nothing. There's no large agriculture pockets in there. You get north of it into Lawrence County and out, you know, toward Coleman and over towards Franklin and whatnot counties. You'll get into a few more, you know, some broken farmland, but It's no, there's no big ag land in there. We plant, our folks plant a few, you know, food plots for wildlife, and but it's nothing to the point where it would affect.
So how, I mean, even though the Wisconsin deer, Michigan deer, I mean, how do they get so big? I mean, of course, you know, Michigan deer are bigger, typically antler, body, everything else than what we have our native Alabama deer. But typically up there, you have farmlands around, and they grow bighorns because they have a lot of protein. How are they getting so big up there?
Well, you know, there's the genetics, which they just have evolved to have bigger. They're just bigger deer than other parts. But the, you know, the big part is if you look at the ages of those deer those guys are killing. They're 5+ years old, a lot of them.
Yeah.
And if you don't know how to hunt, if you've never been to Bankhead and you never hunted at Bankhead and you're from southwest Alabama, it's a whole nother world. It's everything's straight up and down, and it's not easy to hunt. And, you know, again, it's a big block of national forest land, so, you know, it's kind of like hunting, you know, Kinnekin National Forest or Blackwater State Forest there in Florida, and that longleaf stuff, you look at it, it's like, well, hell, it all looks the same.
Right,
you,
yeah.
You got to know how to hunt it. And the guys that are successful up there are guys that have been hunting it all their lives a lot of times.
Yeah.
So they're the ones you see every year, you know, posting a picture of a big deer. But it's just, I think the limited access to a lot of it, that has a big part, just because they get older, 4, 5, 6 years old. And if anywhere you kill a 5 or 6 year old deer, he's you know, he's as good as he's going to get typically. So by having that little bit of a benefit from the northern genetics of those deer that for somehow been able to hang on even in the face of hemorrhagic disease and everything else, and they're just bigger, and they. You know, the numbers are, the deer densities are low for probably several reasons, primarily being habitat and probably hemorrhagic disease. It probably helps keep the numbers down because those deer don't have the resistance to it that these southern deer tend to have. And so, but you don't know all the answers to the puzzle, but I think a lot of it is like what it is in most places. It's got a lot to do with age. You know, we was talking about other WMAs, I think. I don't know if it was when we were on the radio or not, but a lot of them that are killing some better deer are places that maybe access isn't as great as on others. They have gated roads. You have to walk in further than most people are willing to do. So deer, even with or without antler restrictions, deer are getting a little bit older just because people are reluctant to shoot a year-old four-point if he's three-quarters to a mile behind the gate.
You got
to
pack him out. Yeah. Makes a tough pack out. Just, I'm going to go biology class here for a second here in science, and then we'll get into some more rut talk. But with those deer, the strain coming in from Michigan, and I know they're stocking, you know, the state of Alabama stocked some from in the state and some from out of the state. But if you, the thing where we used to roll the dice in biology class, you see the different, you know, the combinations in genetics. How long would it take, though? Because even if you brought those deer in from Michigan, they're surrounded by southeastern deer for mating, and how do they stay an enclave to themselves without getting washed in, the genetics getting washed out from local deer, you know?
Well, back then, the deer, there weren't any deer in that part of the state. So it was basically putting them out there on a blank slate. So it'd be,
okay.
It kind of worked the opposite way now. If you were to bring deer from another source, you know, from Michigan or Texas or Iowa or wherever, I mean, you could bring several hundred and turn them into a free range area like that now in any part of Alabama. Those deer would you know, they would basically not even be any sign that they were ever there on the landscape in 20 years probably. That's exactly what we saw.
They breed out their genetics.
We did a project with Mississippi State just a few years ago, and Bankhead was one of the areas that we sampled DNA from deer that folks were harvesting, and the folks with Michigan also, or Mississippi State also got samples from Michigan to compare to these deer, you know, where they supposedly came from. And they were still very, very similar, if not identical. So they had maintained those northern genetics because primarily there weren't any deer there when they were released, and was before I went to work, but the state released a bunch of deer from Clark County in there back in the late 80s, early 90s to try to, I guess, augment that population and get the numbers up because it, you know, it's always been a low density deer population, and you know, those genes weren't there in that project that we just did recently. They were still the northern deer, so we're talking nearly 400 deer dumped out in a 3-year period, and so
they
after 20 plus years they just kind of got washed out.
Yeah, I mean, it's the flip side. So the Michigan deer, that genetic strain, because it, like, now I understand, came into a blank slate, they are the native population. Other deer will get washed out in their genetics.
Yeah, they're the de facto native deer up
there
now. So.
Cool.
How about that?
So
that's, you know, we saw the same thing over on the northeastern side of the state around Chocolaca WMA. That's another one of the National Forest WMAs, and it and Okmulgee WMA, they were, which is on the National Forest, they were stocked with deer from North Carolina back in the late 30s, early 40s, and Chocolaca, more so than Okmulgee, still has those. They still breed in November, very similar to Black Warrior. Now, Okmulgee, on the other hand, you know, it's in Hale and Bibb County, part of Tuscaloosa and Perry counties, and it's in a part of state where deer were there. Just a few deer, probably, when they released deer way back when. And so those the rut dates over here around Okmulgee look a little different than Chocolaca. That's more like mid-December rather than early December, late November, like over in Cleburne County where Chocolaca's at. So I think that probably had something to do with it, where there was some deer over here when they released those deer. And so it's I don't know if you'd say it's a mix, but they still they still have earlier ruts than most areas around here, but it's not as early as what you see at Chuckawacka.
Yeah, and this perfect transition into what I want. Number one, folks, to go look at the new rut map up for the state, and then kind of walk us through this. First of all, let's.
And where do you find that, Sean?
Chris can tell you. You go to outdooralabama.com, okay. And what do you do here to find that map?
Under hunting, there's some headings at the top. Under hunting, there's what to hunt. Is one of the things in the drop-down menu,
mm-hmm.
And under that you'll go to a deer, and then
he's doing it right now with us.
Yeah, I know.
I can link it up.
And then on that page, the deer page, deer hunting in Alabama page, just scroll down a little ways, and that map is right there. And
awesome.
You could probably.
I'll put it up on our Facebook page, too.
I was trying to do a search bar for rut map.
Yeah.
Coming up.
And I can put it up on the Facebook page for the show and all that. People can get it.
It is very interesting.
Deer hunting, and it take you to that web page, or to that page on our website. But it's deer hunting in Alabama, basically, is worth the page that it's on.
Well, congratulations to you and the crew, because it is the best rut map I've ever seen for our state.
It is awesome.
It's taken in things that I know, but it's also given me new information. Let's do this before, because we'll go to a break here and before we dive into it. But give us the earliest, from what y'all have studied, the earliest rut peak and the latest rut. What are the bookends in the state of Alabama?
Yeah, the earliest area where we've been able to get some samples and get a good number of samples is over on the Chattahoochee River around Russell and Barber County. There's some deer over there start breeding in early November. Actually, one of the sites that we sampled a few years ago, all the deer that we sampled had actually been bred before gun season even opened over there. So,
man, that's like some upper Midwest stuff. That's like some Northeast
that's that
stuff.
That Georgia effect. You get over
there. Yeah, that's right next to Georgia.
They have that. And theirs is not, some of their, they have some pockets of areas where, or a few areas that were stocked with deer from Wisconsin, but most of their restocking came from deer on the coastal, the barrier islands, and so those deer rut really early too. Same way on up into South Carolina. So that's kind of a...
So early November, that area, that's the earliest rut in Alabama.
Yeah. And then you get down into y'all's part of the world, southwest Alabama, and you get into those February average dates of conception. We've had a few places that's even later than that, on into later February, but for the most part, those are kind of outliers, kind of like that one I was telling you about that where they were breeding before gun season ever opened. You get most of them are in the latest window on this rut map is right around that first week of February is when the peak breeding is occurring. So you throw 10 days either side of that, and that's the breeding window in those areas. So
we're gonna come back. We'll talk more about that. And you mentioned Russell County too. I'm gonna get him to talk about this thing. I've heard it from a buddy who used to work on a piece of property over in that world part of the world. He said, Jean, we had two, maybe three different rut peaks on the lands we managed over there. I can't wait to talk about this and all the places in between and how they get this information, how we now have this better mapping. We'll continue our conversation with Chris Cook when we come back right here on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward. Always
a treat. What a great show.
Always a treat to talk to Chris Cook, Deer Program Coordinator for Alabama Division of Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries. Right now we're talking about the new rut map that's out over at OutdoorAlabama.com. You're going to see detail that you've been waiting to see for a long time. And we're talking about these days. I mean, as early as early November to on into February, there's rut activity in our state. Now, the bulk of the state, Chris, I mean, the bulk of the state is what? One or two zones probably comprise the bulk of the peak rut date?
Most of the deer in the state is going to be bred basically from Christmas until the end of January. So.
Right. So that's going to, of course, I, like anybody, focus on the the anomalies. But the interesting, during the news break, we were talking there, and you said something really telling about those rut dates around the state. And we know, at least down here, people talk about the deer that came out of the Stimson Sanctuary. They were taken to restock, you know, different parts of the state. And, of course, those are deer from the Alabama Tombigbee River Swamp that went other places. But you did point out that the area, and I want to get back into that in a second, but you did point out that area of west central Alabama has a little bit different rut. And you say that's area that wasn't restocked. So that's more of a native to that area, maybe more indicative of what might be the rut if we hadn't done moving around.
You know, that's kind of, you just kind of use anecdotal data based on what you, what we're seeing now and what we know about what was restocked. But you look at, like in Sumter, Green, Hale, Pickens, those areas weren't restocked. Or if they were, most of them weren't restocked.
Right.
And so you can look, and as you look at the map, you see there's a kind of a transition from that mid to late January to late December, early January, right along about the, in those counties, about halfway up those counties. And that very likely is, you know, don't know how that line would have went across the state, if it would have went straight east or dropped down, you know, southeast or whatever. But more than likely, the bulk of the state, at least half of it, probably would have been that Christmas to mid-January rut dates if we hadn't restocked. Because if you start looking at the map, you see the spots of the January, late January stuff and February stuff, and even the things we were talking about before, the really early ruts. Those are areas that were stocked with deer from either down in southwest Alabama or deer from out of state, and they were restocked at times when there weren't any deer in those parts of the state. So,
you know, that's
something. Why you have those little pockets, kind of outliers here and there. But if we'd have just let deer come back from from what might have been there, or just naturally expanded to those areas, we probably looked a little different. Probably would have been more of a Christmas rut, primarily over most of the state. But
Chris, you know,
can't do nothing about it now. But that's kind of, you kind of speculate what it would have looked like based on what we know now. But it is, like I said before, it is what it is, and we've got it, and we just have to work with it.
Chris, there's a lot of people who don't realize that back in the 1960s, you know, there weren't a lot of deer in Alabama.
Oh, yeah.
Except in certain areas, up and down the Tombigbee, Alabama River, there was a lot of deer. But when you got outside of that, a lot of places, there weren't any deer anywhere. There was a lot of people back in the 60s that if they saw a deer track, man, the whole neighborhood wanted to come and community wanted to come look at it. Couldn't believe it'd be a deer track there, you know?
Yeah. Even areas of the state that, you know, in people's minds, you know, they've always been places with lots of deer and big deer, like the Black Belt.
Right.
You know, they weren't deer in eastern Marengo County and Perry County and all through there. That was all ag back then.
That's right. So in the 60s, there weren't.
They were dairies and row crops. And
right.
So I guess your perspective just can change quite a bit, just depending on how long you've been around and who you talk to. But
that's right.
It's definitely... definitely a different world back in the 60s and 70s. I know where I grew up down in Florida was that way. And I started hunting when I was a kid. We didn't deer hunt. Everybody dog hunted, but it was kind of a big deal when they killed one.
Right.
It wasn't. But now they're everywhere, and they're a nuisance for a lot of folks.
Yeah, we know.
It's like that in a lot of parts of the world. But it's a lot of things a lot of people don't realize. A lot of them are spoiled. If you want to put it that way, they've been through the probably the best it's going to be when during those times when populations were expanding and deer quality was great, deer numbers were high, and now you kind of you've gone past that and things are starting to moderate in a lot of these areas and it's not what they were used to or and a lot of people's memories probably aren't as good as they are because you. Like with everything, you always remember the really, really good or really, really bad. You don't remember what the bulk of, what the average was. That's what most people, they want to remember the best or the worst.
Yeah. Well, when I first started hunting up in Marengo County back in the mid-70s, I guess. You'd go all year, and you might not see but 6, 8, 10, 12 deer. I mean, you know, think about that. Marengo County,
right,
hunting in the mid-70s and only see less than 20 deer all year long.
And then you go hunt on the river on the other side of Marengo County and there'd be hundreds of deer.
Oh, yeah. In a field, there'd be 100 deer in one field.
Yeah.
Yes.
I want to talk about this, though. I mean, this is kind of two questions in one. So let's talk about that river swamp. Number one, because I love talking river swamp. Number two, I think this goes into this rut timing, that there's this later rut for deer that came out of the river swamp to restock different areas. And this has all got to be based, right, in the deep history of deer. Let's not worry about 1960. Let's talk about from the Pleistocene on or whatever we're dealing with. That when the rut is based on when you want the fawns to drop, right, Chris?
Right. You would think that's why they are what they are. They should be hitting the ground when it's most favorable for them to survive.
So. Okay. So that being true, then you back up from that. And, yeah, and in the river swamp, you want to get them past the floods, right?
Right.
So maybe a little bit because, you know, if you start dropping them early, that's when the river's up. So maybe there's a benefit for that in that population. Now, that's now in a lot of places that there's no flooding. I mean, a long way from the river, but they still carry that genetic reasoning, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Right. And, it, you know, it's because they were, again, stocked from those sources into areas that did not have many deer back then. Or they were allowed to, you know, the deer populations back to turn of the early 1900s in Alabama, they were basically isolated in a few spots, most of it along the Tombigbee River and Alabama River. And so as those populations expanded, especially in these counties that weren't restocked, then you have those deer that probably evolved to have a later conception date because of flood dates or flood timing. And then you compound that with the restocking, and so that's where we are now. And you talked about the deer from the coastal islands and off of Georgia and South Carolina, and probably because of hurricane season.
Mm-hmm.
They evolved to breed really early. So the fawns had hit the ground early and would be up, you know, a little bit bigger by the time the hurricane started coming in late summer and fall. So,
it's amazing.
It's amazing.
So those deer start breeding. I know friends of mine that hunted around Charleston and whatnot, they said as soon as the antlers, you know, as soon as the velvet come off antler, they were breeding, you know, so they were breeding in September.
Wow.
A lot of times, especially in areas that were really well managed where they had tight sex ratios and a good age structure in their buck populations. It was on as soon as the antlers were hard. So it's pretty
unusual
to see the differences in places that aren't that far apart. And so.
Well, I want to get into some places that aren't far apart because one of the anomalies people will see when they open up this map, the new rut map for Alabama, this area of Russell and Barber County, mm-hmm. that within Russell and Barber County, there are, what, five different rut peaks within those counties?
Yeah there's
five, y'all.
Within 20 miles of Eufaula in Barber County. We've looked at this. This is one of the things that jumped out when we first started collecting this data back in the mid-90s was the big difference in conception dates. Collected deer from Eufaula National Wildlife Refuge, which is, called, of course, right on the river. Those deer were breeding in as some of those November breeders. Just a property right on the city limits of Eufaula, which is, you know, basically it's right on the river, but you get right on the city limits on a property one of our biologists hunted, and those deer were breeding in mid-December. And then you go 20 miles from there to Barber WMA, which is an area that was stocked with deer from Clark County, and they were breeding in mid to late January. And we did some genetic stuff, and they were three different, you know, they weren't genetically the same, so they were different. So it's appears that the deer from Eufaula Refuge, they were some of that bleed over from Georgia stuff, the stuff right on the city limits of Eufaula that bred in mid-December appeared to be kind of, basically, we concluded, and the guys that did the DNA stuff for us concluded they had to have been some remnant deer that evolved from a remnant population that were able to hang on there in that area. And then the ones on Barber were just like the ones from Stimson, so they had maintained that identity. So it's pretty interesting. But yeah, it's all at least in that area, it appears to be all based on where the deer came from.
Yeah, if you're a buck that was a ladies, or should I say does buck kind of thing, it'd be travel a few miles and keep yourself in the party.
And you'd be dead at the end of the year because you're running.
Correct. You wouldn't make it through across a lot of those lines out there. All right, so it's just neat. I had a buddy that worked over there who told me about that. He said, man, we'd have clients and we'd tell them they were hunting the peak of the rut no matter when they called. They said, hey, I came last year in November. You told me we're hunting peak. And now it's December. You said we're hunting peak. January, you said we're hunting peak. You said you are. I'm moving you on different properties to keep you in the peak. Let's talk about how y'all got this information. How do you know what you know about the peak rut dates?
Well, it started back in the mid-90s. Actually, biologists with, at that time, Gulf States Paper Corporation and James River Paper Company, or James River. Paper company. They approached the state about getting a permit to collect data from deer on their properties, looking at conception dates and reproductive health. And I helped those guys. That was the first year I moved to Demopolis and was helping those guys on some properties in Pickens and Sumter and Choctaw counties. And that kind of started the ball to rolling because they collected data and said, well, this looks a little different than what people have been always telling us when the rut dates were. And so it expanded from there, and our folks got more involved, and we've collected data from 200 and some odd sites over that period from 95, 96 through last year, this year. And using that data, we've been able to get a pretty good handle on one, when the deer breed, which is important to the hunters than anybody, but also got a good feel for how productive some of these populations are, what the potential for productivity is on these areas. It's rare to find a deer that's not bred, an adult doe, and it's probably you're more likely on most of these areas to find you're just as likely to find a deer with the 2 years old with triplets as you are to see with a single if they're healthy. So, the average and nearly all of them have twins. But if it's a 2-3 year old doe and she's got a single, or she's not bred, typically it's probably something wrong with her. Either she was sick during something happened to her during the breeding window, and so she either didn't get bred, or something happened after she conceived, and so she's not as healthy, and she may have only have one fetus. But it's pretty interesting, the info, but it's stuff that we started collecting back in the mid-90s and got a really good data set. It's over, I think, 3,000 deer or so in that data set, but it's
pretty good sample size.
And the we've got a lot of sites that we were based on or because of access or just difficulty in collecting these deer, we weren't able to get very, very many samples. And so the map that you're talking about, this is just using data from the areas that we had good sample sizes from. So,
but that will change as time goes on because you're still continuing to do samples.
A lot of your listeners may have seen the earlier map that was on our website and been put out there. It was basically a map with different colored dots on it. And those dots represented a 2-week window of breeding. And a lot of those dots kind of were outliers, and some of those were areas that we didn't have good sample sizes for. And so as we were able to, moving forward, we'll go into those areas where it looks like, there might be some, if you look at the map, like on Butler and Lowndes and Crenshaw County, it's kind of broken right through there, and some other areas where you've got these little, you've got a green or whatever dot in the middle of a big area of another color. You go in and do some more sampling around those areas to see if those if those outliers are the norm or if they are outliers, and try to get it blended more than it is, maybe. Or it may, you know, you may find what we're seeing now exactly what it is, regardless of how many deer we collect. And so we were able to use that data and using some GIS software and modeling, and or not necessarily modeling, but our assistant chief, Amy Silvano, she's a lot more skilled at any of that than I am, and so she was able to take that data and get us a better, more user-friendly map than just one with dots on it. So Amy deserves all the credit for making the map, for sure.
Well, tell her I said well done. If you're just joining us, talking to Chris Cook, Deer Program Coordinator with the state of Alabama, I want to go back to something you said earlier, and I just want to check in. So the normal... The average level of reproduction for a doe should be twins, or should, because I
once they after they've had their first fawn, you know, the first conception, their first pregnancy is typically a single. Occasionally we'll find a year and a half old, or, you know, a doe that was a year and a half during the rut that has twins, but most of those have singles. But after that, they typically, as long as they're healthy, they typically will have twins, or will have twins in utero.
Yeah.
Whether they carry them full term, or once they give birth to twins, the likelihood of them raising both of them, of course, is not 100%. But on really good areas where deer are healthy and good habitat, and, you know, different management practices in place, like predator control, in areas where that may be an issue, that can all figure into it. But typically, the potential is there for an adult doe to produce two fawns every year.
Let's do this. Can you hold on? We'd run to the break real fast and come back. All right. Coming right back. More of our talk about the rut in Alabama and a few final questions as we wrap up here. All right. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward. Glad to have you along. We continue
our... This is a show that needs to be recorded and everybody take it to the hunting club and play it at the camp.
That's true. Yes. That's true, because it answers a lot of questions, right?
That's right.
That's what we're about doing here. That's why we bring the pros in, like Chris Cook, Deer Program Coordinator for Alabama Division of Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries. Tell you one of... we're talking about the rut and the rut map out there and this rut timing. You look at the way y'all collect this data, and you were telling us, Chris, you take the fetal age, right, from those does, and that shows you the mean conception date. But what about this secondary rut thing we talk about? The secondary rut. Well, we had a rut, but then those does didn't get bred, and they're coming back in. Is that a thing? Is that real?
Yeah, it's definitely real. It happens more often on areas that, where the adult sex ratio might be skewed, because typically if you have a fairly well-balanced sex ratio, adult sex ratio, say two adult does for every buck, and a decent age structure in your buck population, then those are going to get bred in a 2 to 2.5 week window. But if, for whatever reason, management practices or whatnot, the sex ratio's, you know, 3+ does per buck, then it's just not possible for all the bucks to get to every doe before she'll go out of heat. And so she'll recycle in about 28 days, and so a lot of times that's that secondary rut. It's just the stragglers coming back in the estrus and being ready to be bred. So,
and
we're not like a lot of the Midwestern northern states where probably more of their secondary rut is just fawns that are maturing to the point where they come into estrus, and so they have that action going on. Ours are born so late that typically they're not physically mature enough to reach estrus, and so you might see on a really well-managed property, you might see 20% of yearling does lactating, which shows that they were bred as fawns, you know, the year before, and it's just not a real common thing in most of Alabama, but
so the
breeding of adult does that didn't get bred the first go around is not that uncommon.
Okay, so that's the difference. That's one thing I was wondering. You know, people talk about it. Maybe it is elsewhere that yearling doe finally has gotten to where can have estrus. And but in our case, it's just the number of does versus the number of bucks. He can only do so much.
Yeah, that's typically what it is. It's, you know, because the data that we collected in areas where the breeding is prolonged, say 40-plus days, it's does of all ages. You know, it could be very well a doe that's 3 or 4 years old that got bred on what appears to be the second cycle, just as easy as it is a year-and-a-half-old doe. So,
it's
more of a function of them not having a suitor at the time that she needed it. So she come back around, and so there's a lot fewer targets, so she's a lot more likely to get bred on the second go-around.
That can skew the data a little bit too, can't it?
Yeah, and that's where you got to be careful looking at it, and we tried to take some of that out of it and look at the percentage of deer that are bred in this window as opposed to the whole window. And
right.
So that'll try to tighten it up, and that, again, that goes back to where better sample sizes, bigger sample sizes over more years give you a lot more confidence in what you're seeing.
Yeah, let's talk about the other side of getting information on our deer population. Y'all are doing this part to figure out mean conception and rut, but overall numbers in the state, overall trends, that's why y'all have us, you know, get the app open on our phone and report what we've shot, even does.
Right. Yeah, you know, using the data that we have, it, you know, we get stuff other than the date of conception from these deer. We're looking at potential productivity, you know, how many fetuses are the does carrying, and what percentage of does are bred and all that. You can use that information to help reconstruct populations. But a more important part of the data that we need is what's being killed, you know, bucks and does. And that's why we have Game Check. And it's not to try to – it's not because we're the boogeyman trying to get something on you. We want the data.
Right.
You know, to help us better manage these wildlife populations, deer populations, for the folks that are using them now and people that's going to be using them on down the road. It's not a get you type thing. It's stuff you need as a biologist to manage populations. You got to know what's coming in through the reproductive health checks that we've done, and then you want to know what's coming out through the harvest data. So
what's the percentage
that,
of people?
Without that, it's just like a checking account. If you don't know what's coming in, what's going out, you're going to find yourself in a crack before long. And so we're fortunate in that deer populations are very resilient. You can abuse them and they still stick around. And so, but we want to manage them as best we can. So we don't want to just beat it like a rented mule and well, it's always going to be there. We want to do what's right and have a healthy, well-managed population for folks to enjoy. And without data, it becomes more difficult, and it's not to the potential that it could be.
So what do you think the percentage of the people, the hunters, are that is using Game Check now? I know when it first got started, it was low, and it's got to be getting better and better. And, you know, a lot of people, I still think, they don't even know it's the law yet.
It's amazing how... I don't know if it's just trying to plead ignorance or actually being just don't know, because it's amazing how many people didn't know that you had to have a harvest log, and that's been in place for a long time, way before the Game Check stuff. We encounter that. We still encounter that with folks and it's not new hunters. This is guys that's been hunting.
So right.
It's I hate to venture a guess what percentage is being harvested. If you just look at what's reported in Game Check, and we do a phone survey following hunting season, where we contract with a outside vendor to call folks and ask them a certain set of questions, trying to get estimates of how many days they hunted, how many hunters were actually out there, and what they killed, deer, turkey, everything that's available to be harvested. If you just look at those numbers compared to the Game Check numbers, it's about a third of the deer reported. But then if you talk to the folks that handle a lot of deer, like processors, their estimates are a whole lot less than that. So,
no, what you're saying, not many people are really reporting.
It's
it appears that way. I mean, if you just look at the raw data, yes, at best, we're probably looking at a third of the people reporting what they're harvesting, which, you know, even in states that's had it for a long time that had mandatory reporting, and most of those, you know, it used to be you had to go by a physical check station and get a tag put on the deer and that kind of stuff, but a lot of those have gone away from it and gone to electronic reporting for convenience sake. Even those states, you know, they don't get 100% compliance, but it's a whole lot better than what we're getting. But and that's in areas where they've done it forever.
Well, people still think that, yeah, I got to report my buck when I shoot it.
Yep.
But they don't think about it. They got to report their doe, too. They just thinking it's just buck, just bucks only.
Absolutely. And just from what observations that I've seen and others have seen is people think, one, they don't have to report those, and two, they're a lot more likely to report a good buck as opposed to a smaller buck, because if they get caught, they don't want to lose that big buck. And then they want to show that big buck off. So they got to make sure they got all their ducks in a row before they ride around and show everybody that and post all the pictures on Instagram and Facebook and everything else. So
how are you going to correct that in the future?
You know, my opinion...
Big fines?
Is you know, people tend to correct themselves if there's repercussions for not doing it.
So, right.
I don't know. That's probably the best route. You know, if there's a chance of a better chance of getting caught, and if you get caught, there's some repercussions, and maybe people be more likely to use it. And then again, we've got to do our part and actually use this data. Show people this is what the data is being used for, and we're doing that. We're moving towards. Making more use of the data that's coming in through Game Check and our season recommendations and things like that. So it's slowly getting there, and that's the way it is with most things. Even with the rut date map, you know, we've been collecting that data for a long time, and we finally got it in a format that people say, "Hey, I can see why that data is useful." So hopefully, as we start using it for our management recommendations, which is what it's being collected for, then people start seeing, well, hey, that's I can see why we need to be reporting that.
Right.
So maybe more people will start doing it, and we can have we have more tools in the toolbox to make better plans and better recommendations for what we're doing with the deer population.
Hey, Chris, as always, what this conversation has done is satisfied some questions I had and opened up about 25 others. So well, have to get you back on the show sometime soon.
No problem.
It's been a great show.
Always enjoy it. Yep. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Chris Cook joined us. He is the deer coordinator for the state of Alabama. And more information in like one small part of his brain about deer than most of us combined.
Absolutely.
Always a treat to talk to him. A big thank you to him. And remember, this show up in a podcast form. You can check it out there, fmtalk1065.com, or where you get your podcast.